oral argument this morning on our calendar is Simmons v. Mason. Counsel, while you're getting all squared away, I'll just remind you that each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments, with 5 minutes additional to appellant's counsel that you may use for rebuttal. The timing restrictions or limit is indicated in the podium in the middle, but if you're concerned at all about, if you have any safety concerns about sharing a podium, you certainly are welcome to use the microphone and podium that's closest to your table, since there are three provided. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of the arguments by audio recording and make those arguments public. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Apologize for my voice is a little raspy here, getting over a cold.
And I should mention, if you haven't noticed, that the middle podium does have a button that allows you to raise or lower the platform depending on your height and comfort.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Nick Sperling. I represent appellant Lillian Simmons in this appeal. This appeal is narrow in its scope. It stems from a case where the overall result, a partition by sale, was both appropriate and warranted. However, the trial court's process in determining how that partition was to play out was flawed. It ran contrary to the principles of equity, and it contradicted mandatory provisions of the Minnesota partition statute.
Can I ask you a big picture question about your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not so much as to procedure, but to substance. How clear was the evidence and argument that the parties contributed an unequal amount of funds to the down payment?
We believe, Your Honor, that the down payment, the entire kind of mortgage packet was submitted to the court as evidence, and that's in appellant's brief. We reference the part of the trial court's order where it references the down payment, and then appellant also mentioned the down payment in her testimony. It wasn't a point of emphasis because she was going for a quiet title action. She wasn't testifying as
right,
to a partition. But
I'm not talking about emphasis. I'm just talking about evidence. Was there any evidence that your client contributed or that the parties contributed disproportionately? Is there any evidence that one contributed the entire down payment? I know that's the argument now. I didn't see in the citation that you have to the record, to the district court's finding, that there's any reference to the amounts.
There's not reference to the amounts, Your Honor, but what my client submitted to the trial court was my client was incarcerated at the time she started saving for this home. So she used this, she enrolled in this program called the I believe the Pathways to Home program that incarcerated people can engage in. And so she saved as part of that program. Mr. Mason was not part of the closing or the transaction.
Right, but how do we know? I mean, you want us to, I think, accept as to substance, and I'm not sure that it matters given the quitclaim deed, but you want us to accept that your client had a more substantial ownership interest or quantity-wise, had invested more, and maybe that's so. Maybe that's an inference that one might draw, but if there was no specific evidence about that, and two, I think even equally concerning for your position on appeal, no actual argument made to the below for a finding to be made. The fact that there's no finding usually is troubling, but that's because there's usually argument presented and evidence presented that wasn't responded to. That's the reason it's a concern. Here, I'm not sure there was a basis for the finding that's absent from the findings of fact. Can you address those issues?
We believe that there was, Your Honor, and that's because she was the defendant in the case below. The appellant did submit the that packet of evidence regarding the closing on the property, which included the program that she was involved in. It was a $7,500 monetary contribution from her that was included in that packet, and then...
But the packet doesn't say that who contributed to the $7,500. I mean, we don't... That's the problem I'm having. You want us to take a leap that not only a leap that from the lack of a finding and from the evidence, but in a situation where the argument was never even presented that you're making.
I agree, Your Honor, that it wasn't presented properly or thoroughly at trial, but we believe that it still should have been a factor given that the down payment was made solely by Ms. Simmons.
Well, you keep saying that.
Right.
But I mean, that's, you know, that, if it's true, might be relevant, might not, by the way, because of you've got a quitclaim deed that doesn't attempt to suggest any difference in ownership interest. And maybe you should turn to that.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. That's another, I think, issue that feeds into that is that Mr. Mason, the respondent, didn't receive the quitclaim deed to this property until at least a couple months into Ms. Simmons' ownership of the property. So she solely closed on the property herself. Mr. Mason was not involved in the closing at all. So she purchased the property solely. And then the quitclaim deed didn't occur until a few months later
And why is
in
that
her
a
ownership.
Concern? I'm trying to figure out what is the issue with...
Well, that just goes to show that Mr. Mason was not involved with the down payment or any sort of financing of the
How
down payment.
How is that so? I mean, it wouldn't... I mean, parties could say, you know what, I want to purchase a house, I want to purchase it through this program, I've got to come up with a certain amount of money for the down payment, it's going to be matched.
Right.
I don't quite have it, can you help me? We don't know what was going on in the background. All we know is that she was the one identified as the mortgagee, and...
Correct. Through this program, I mean, incarcerated persons have to save up money, and then there's a matching funds at the end. So I don't believe that Mr. Mason could have contributed to the monetary down payment. And again, he wasn't involved in closing. He didn't sign any of the closing paperwork. So I don't believe
that
was the case.
My point is, it wouldn't be, you agree, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, if you disagree, that parties certainly could arrange it the way I've suggested and then say, you know, when this is all done, you know, make sure I get a quitclaim deed so that I have an ownership interest.
That certainly could be the case, Your Honor. There's no evidence supporting that at trial, but yes, I agree.
Contradicting that. Because the issue wasn't raised.
Correct.
And again, I guess let me go back to a more fundamental question. Why does it even matter? We're talking about an equitable division of property under a statute that allows for partitioning. You've got two parties with a quitclaim deed that simply identifies them both as the owner without any indication of one having a greater share in the ownership. So with that, why would it even matter?
We believe that's one factor in kind of a bucket of factors, and we believe there's three factors here. So the equal division is the first factor, Your Honor. The second factor is that the trial court erred in failing to assign the costs of the referees to plaintiff in the case, which the plaintiff seeking partition in this case was Mr. Mason, and that was in contradiction.
You don't address. I mean, you build your argument on 558.06. I don't know that you actually addressed expressly in your brief 558.16.
558.16, Your Honor?
Right. The respondent relies on that provision, which I'll just read it if you don't have it right in front of you. The proceeds of the sale, and this is in connection with the distinction between partitioning in kind and a sale. The proceeds of the sale of the property shall be applied under the direction of the court as follows. One, to pay the just proportion, to pay its just proportion of the general cost of the action. Two, to pay the costs of the reference. And I think that's what is being relied upon as a basis for shared payment to the referees.
I don't doubt that that's the case. I don't think that was relied on in the order. I believe it's relied on by respondent, but that contradicts the language in 558.06, where it says that.
When we say contradicts, I mean, mm-hmm. if the legislature has language that contradicts, we have to figure out, maybe they mean, as the respondent says, that these are two different circumstances. One is the sale and one is the partitioning kind.
I misspoke when I said contradicts, Your Honor. I believe both can be true, where the cost of the reference can come out of the proceeds of the sale of the property, but then the plaintiff shall pay the referees, surveyors, and assistants under 558.06. So that would come out of plaintiff's share of the net proceeds. So again, it's the order as written creates a windfall for a respondent at the expense of appellant.
Well, I'm not sure how it's a windfall if they're sharing the cost. I think your argument is just that it's inconsistent with the statute.
It's inconsistent with the statute, Your Honor, yes.
Which would, as you interpret it, would provide a windfall to your client.
We don't believe that it would. With Mr. Mason having brought the partition action, I mean, my client never wanted this property to be partitioned, so we believe that the party seeking the partition should rightly pay the costs of the partition action, or the cost of the referees in this instance. But before we even get there, Your Honor, so what we've been talking about here is in the context of a public sale. And we believe that the trial court usurped the referee's ability to, do some fact-finding and find out whether there should be an unequal share here. But before we even get there, the private sale issue under 558.17 is equally concerning, and we think that's of paramount importance here, that my client intended to purchase this property by private sale. This has always been her residence. To my knowledge, Mr. Mason hasn't lived there for quite some time. That statute, 558.17, says that the property shall be appraised by two or more disinterested persons under order of the court, which appraisal shall be filed before the court confirmation of the sale by the court. No real estate shall be sold at private sale for less than its value as fixed by such an appraisal.
The statute says if the private sale is ordered.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In this case, it's tough to construe it as an order. I mean, would it be wrong to interpret this as a directive by the court to allow the parties to try a private sale, try a private sale, and if it doesn't work out, we'll go to public sale? If it wasn't, a direct order, you must convey the property through a private sale.
The language of the order, Your Honor, I think makes clear that the parties were ordered to negotiate the terms of a private sale by, within 30 days.
Right, but if they couldn't, it wasn't a you must negotiate and complete the sale. It was you must negotiate with the intent to have a private sale. But if it doesn't come to fruition, we'll have a public sale.
We construe the order, Your Honor, as ordering a private sale, and if a private sale can't be accomplished, then a public sale would take place. But we believe that the court skipped the
ordering step. A private sale, ordering an attempt have a private sale, but the statute refers to ordering of a private sale.
We believe this the order should be construed as ordering a private sale, Your Honor. The parties were to try. Yes,
did a private sale occur?
It did not, Your Honor. They were unable to come to terms.
The order?
If the parties couldn't come to terms on the private sale, then you'd move into the public sale where the referees would be appointed.
So then they weren't ordered.
I believe they were, Your Honor, but they weren't given the framework, where in a private sale you need an appraisal. The parties were very far apart on the pricing, and there's no way to refinance a property based on agreement of individuals on what the value is, and that's what my client would have needed to have done.
I guess here's the problem I have. So if the parties couldn't have reached agreement on their own, and let's say hypothetically, then all right, then we're going to have appraisals come in, and we're going to say what the price is. Why would that be more likely to lead to an agreement by the parties?
The value would be determined, Your Honor, and then the
right. But the court has said if you don't agree, you can go to a public sale. So why would the appraisal comes in? Let's say the appraiser comes in and Mr. Mason says no, I'm not going to. I'm not going to agree to that, even if it's the most reasonable, it seems the most reasonable price. The court's order seems to say you don't have to sell it by private sale. You can then go to public sale. So I'm trying to get a sense of what the consequence is.
Sure.
Prejudices your client.
Your Honor, our position is that the parties could not have completed a private sale based on the court's order, because the private sale provision says that not only must there be an appraisal, but that appraisal has to be filed before the court, and no real estate shall be sold at private sale for less than its value fixed by such appraisal. So without that appraisal, no private sale could have occurred.
Right, but the parties couldn't agree on a price, right? So
correct.
Why would an appraisal have changed that part of the problem with the reaching an agreement?
Well, first of all, it was required. Second of all, it would have given the parties a barometer of what the value of the property was, so they could come to an agreement on the purchase price for the property. And then that appraisal would have been filed with the court, pursuant to 558.17, Your Honor. So we believe that was a direct violation of the statute. I see my time is ending here, so thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes
for rebuttal. Absolutely.
So
thank you.
Gather your thoughts and come back for the fourth quarter. Counsel for respondent.
I believe I may have a touch of the same raspy throat as appellant's counsel.
Well, that's good. Then neither of you can blame the other.
Is everyone ready? Counsel, the court? Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Stephen Applegett. My last name is spelled Applegett for respondent Quincy Mason. I think to address some of the confusion that was evidenced right at the end of appellant's argument, let's get into a little bit about precisely what the district court ordered, because I think there's a little confusion here. The district court ordered essentially a three-step process. The first step was the parties had 30 days to attempt to settle this themselves, to reach their own deal on whatever sort of terms the parties could come to an agreement on. The second step in the court's process was, if this failed, the parties will confer and submit applications for various referees in order to get the property set up for sale, to get it appraised, and comply with the various portions of the statute. When that is done, there could still then be 30 days for a private sale where appellant buys out respondent based on that appraisal. Now, as you indicated, Judge Ross, of course, respondent, Mr. Mason, might not want to go through with that, might decide that he can't afford it, or in fact, the appellant might decide, I don't even like this price. Nothing. The third stage is where we...
Either party could decide they don't.
Yeah, either party. Either party could decide we're not following through on that. The third stage then is, okay, these parties are not going to agree. They can't make a deal. It's off to public sale where it gets handled with all the formality of being auctioned off by the sheriff, which, I think in everyone's experience, the sheriff sale is probably not the best option for everyone. So it's sort of a series of increasingly potentially more expensive, more difficult, and less good response, situations for the parties till eventually this matter is resolved. And hopefully it's resolved on good terms for everyone.
So if I could follow up, do you, in a nutshell, believe the district court ordered an appraisal?
Yes, but not immediately. The appraisal comes after the parties have a chance to resolve this without further cost and expense, without having to hire referees, without having to hire appraisers. If they can make a deal based on the assistance that the court gave, because the court assisted them by saying, you know, this quiet title action, yeah, this unjust enrichment claim, nah, there's nothing there. You two just need to divide, come up with a price, and settle this. If they could do that, that's great. We love settled cases.
What's your position as to whether the court, in the vernacular of the statute, ordered a private sale?
The court, or I think the court is somewhat vague here. And I think the court is exercising its equitable powers to craft sort of an elegant and equitable solution to the situation of the parties. Instead of saying there must be private sale, so that's, we can do something a little bit more equitable here than simply the plain and ordinary put it on the market order to use as I referenced, sort of the increased pressure on the parties to make a deal until, well, if you can't make a deal that you can agree with.
I'm asking the question in the context of 558.17, which has the mandatory language, shall be appraised by two or more disinterested persons under order of the court, but the triggering event is if a private sale is ordered.
I think the court is sort of in a vague territory there, but we don't have to worry about that too much because if we are in step two of the process, the court has ordered that there be an appraisal done.
Well, not according to statute, be appraised by two or more disinterested persons.
Right. And I think if we look at, you know, various cases such as Carlson v. Olson and Anderson v. Anderson, the court has the district court has sort of the equitable authority to make something that actually works for the parties.
Provided it's not inconsistent.
Provided
with the statute.
Correct. Although to find that the court acted in an inconsistent way with the statute here would have to hold that the court in Anderson v. Anderson and Carlson v. Olson were incorrectly decided.
What about consistency with section 0.06 and the referees? It says shall divide the property and allot the portions to the respective parties. Do you see a discrepancy between what the district court did and what this particular statute says the referees shall do?
I think there is, as Judge Ross pointed out, there is a difference between proceeding under 558.06 and 558.16, that an 06 proceeding is where there is going to be some sort of physical separation of the parties, like sawing the old Heidelberg in half in Northfield, Minnesota, in order to move it to do two different lots. That's the sort of thing we're looking at. We're looking at perhaps the situation in the Newman case with the dairy farm with three owners. But that's not what we're doing here. And if this couple had been married, this would have been done in family court long ago. The simple, you know, refinance or sell out sort of thing. This is, unfortunately, it's an unmarried couple, so we have to piece it together under the partition statute. But the partition statute in 558.16, I think, allows a more simplified proceeding, and that certainly seems to be the case in the actual actual decisions from the Supreme Court when they come up, that we can do this in a simplified way. Not every case is as complicated as Newman with three owners of two plots that are that together make a productive dairy farm. This is just a suburban tract house. It can't be cut in half. It needs to be sold off, or one party needs to buy out the other.
Now, the statute obviously provides some legal rights as regards property division, but it's really in the context of an equitable proceeding where the court, as you've indicated, can sort of paint in the gray areas between the provisions of the statute. In light of the equitable nature of the remedy here baked into the statute, explain why it would be fair, assuming that there has been a different contribution amount to the down payment, why it would be fair not to reflect a different ownership value to the parties.
Now, if we make that assumption, I think you're correct, Judge Ross. The problem is we can't just assume. We need to look at what the evidence is. And the evidence...
The only evidence, I mean, there's no evidence that suggests that your client contributed to the down payment. The only evidence we have as to anyone contributing to the down payment is the program that Ms. Simmons was in, and that she, and the district court said she purchased the house, sort of at least implies that she's the one who provided the down payment exclusively.
It does suggest that, but it was not argued. There is no evidence provided of, as you indicated, what the source of the funds were, as in, did it come to it? Did all those funds come from Ms. Simmons? And also, I mean, the court found that this wasn't just Mr. Mason coming into someone who had a house. The court found that these two had shopped together, that they had been looking for houses together. And the court found that they did the financing this way because even as an ex-felon, Ms. Simmons had better credit. And that's how they decided to make this deal. And the stuff that we have that memorializes the agreement between the parties is pretty limited.
Do we know one way or the other whether this program that she was involved in for the matching of funds, whether it required her to be the exclusive owner?
I have no idea, Your Honor. I haven't seen evidence either way on this. So there's really no reason to give the parties the extra burden of the extra expense of retaining referees, retaining appraisers, of getting a poor deal unless the parties can't agree. As to this down payment issue, as the court has indicated, there's simply the evidence is just lacking. The argument was lacking. It just wasn't there for the district court. The district court had the record of the testimony of the parties, a few documents, and that's it. If appellant wants or wanted to make an argument about how the ownership was not actually equal, even though that's not supported by any of the documentation that we know of, appellant had a full and fair opportunity to do that. But the court found otherwise. The court found that this was a household, that they had made their own at best, excuse me, not at best, but, you know, arguably informal, just and fair determination themselves of who owned how much of this property. And there really isn't anything to counter that. Now, I still have 2 3/4 minutes, but I don't really have anything else to say, Your Honors. So unless the court has any questions, I'll turn it over to respondents' counsel. To appellant's counsel.
I'm a firm believer in the proverbial maxim, in the multitude of words, sin is unavoidable. So if you have nothing to say, you should probably say nothing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I also don't have a whole lot for rebuttal here, but I do believe that One of the central or overarching issues here in this appeal is how much discretion the trial court has to fashion a remedy in a partition action. And we don't dispute that the trial court does have great latitude, great discretion to fashion a remedy. But really what the dispute is over here is we're referring to all those parts of the partition statute that use the word shall and not may. Those that demand compliance with certain statutory requirements. And that's where we believe the language from the Swager v. Taylor case comes in, where, you know, the statutory, you know, the courts have, you know, can use general equitable principles to fill out the silent spaces in the partition statutes, but the statutory part of the partition procedure must be followed.
You agree, I assume you agree, that if and I know you would challenge the premise,
yep,
but if the district court did not, under 558.17, order the property to be sold in a private sale, then you would agree, I assume, that there is no triggering of the two or more disinterested appraisers requirement.
The issue there, Your Honor, I agree with that in principle, Your Honor, but the only thing I would add to that is that there would be no way to confirm a private sale without that appraisal being submitted to the court under 558.17. That's another shall that's included in the statute, that upon that appraisal, it shall be submitted to the court, and no sale shall take place without having that appraisal.
But both of those shalls are triggered by an actual ordering of a private sale.
Correct, but there would be no way to facilitate that private sale or enter it into the court for the court to actually, if, for example, Your Honor, if the parties would have just said, the value for this property is $300,000, we both agree on it, the court could not have ordered the private sale under this statute. That's our argument. The appraisal needed to have been completed and needed to have been done by two or more disinterested persons, had to be filed with the court, and then the real estate couldn't be sold at a private sale for less than its value as fixed by that appraisal.
But that's in context, as fixed by such appraisal, which
correct,
means that there's a sequence here. One, ordering, this property will be sold, period, private sale. Two, you get a couple of appraisals, maybe more, and then the court's going to decide which of the appraisals is the actual value of the property. And we're not going to require, no real estate shall be sold at a private sale for less than the value fixed by such appraisal, such being the appraisal that occurs ordered by the court after the court orders the private sale. In other words, this makes perfect sense. I mean, it's in the interest of fairness, the legislature is saying, look, court, you can't make parties sell the property for less than the fair value of the property. But in this case, that never happened. The court never ordered a private sale. As I read the court's order, it would seem to be contingent upon the party's agreement.
In there, Your Honor, I believe that's where there's ambiguity in the court's order, because it says, yes, try to negotiate a private sale on your own without the involvement of appraisers, referees, or anybody. But then to get to the actual private sale, to confirm the private sale, the court would have had to have an appraisal at some point. It couldn't have.
If it was ordering it. But if the parties agreed on their own mm-hmm. to a sale, there would be no need for the court to order the private sale.
I believe that a private sale still would have been ordered under those circumstances.
Well, if the parties stipulated to the value mm-hmm. of the cost based upon an agreement, sure, the court could order then. But that wouldn't be inconsistent with the statute, would it?
I believe that it would be, Your Honor. I believe that an appraisal still would be required to have been entered into the court.
Even if the parties agreed to the price?
That's correct, Your Honor. There isn't anything permissive about the statute, in our view, Your Honor. With that, I see my time is winding down. Any last questions?
I don't believe there are any.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the court having afforded us the opportunity to argue this case.
Well, thank you both for your argument and for coming today and providing an oral argument in addition to your briefing. We do appreciate it. Interesting case. I'd say I've been here for quite a while. It's the first partition case I think I've had, so thank you for presenting it to us. We will consider the matter. It's submitted. It's under advisement. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. And that is the last case we have on our oral calendar today, so we're in recess.